The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Everyone's talking about the revolution driven by Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Hello there, and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome indeed to the programme this morning. And we start, I suppose, with the one that you won't want to hear at all, which is that Aer Lingus is to be hit by, quote, a summer of strikes. And that is on the front of the Irish Daily Mail. I think the whole business about a summer of strikes, i.e. a day here and a day there that you don't know about in advance, is just extraordinarily upsetting for the travelling public. Mind you, I presume the unions do that because they say it'll be more effective from their point of view. Now, the Irish Times, Gilmore sought reassurances on taping. This is basically, which I suppose is not one bit surprising, that Mr. Gilmore also spoke to the Attorney General after all the hoo-ha, or during all the hoo-ha this week. My God, they say a week is a long time in politics. 10 minutes seem to be a long time in politics sometimes going through this week. They also say that Europe's top civil servant urges patience on bailout concessions. And I presume she does that for all the right reasons, but that's nearly as depressing, I suppose, as the business about the Aer Lingus strikes. They also have a story about Trinity dropping the Bible from their branding, so to speak. Now, the Irish Examiner, most Garda recordings likely to have been erased. The prospect of large-scale court challenges recedes, and so on and so on. The system of recording used physical tapes, which were rotated and taped over repeatedly. And if that is so, the material is gone. And I speak from as one who knows this painfully, because at a certain time that was the practice in here for programmes that were put on huge tapes. And they were very expensive, so after a certain while, you use them again, which means that you've lost wonderful material, or what you thought was wonderful material, and that you would like to use again. But and there it is, gone, so to speak. Now, the Irish Independent. Energy price war heats up as new player vows to slash bills by 17%. And as you know, we did coverage on one big switch, and that turned out to be a terrific success, and that was offering people a 10% discount and €80 cash back if they stick with the supplier for a year. But now somebody else has come in and said we'll do better than that, and consumers could shave more than 300 off the cost of their general energy. They're going to cut prices by 17%. So hallelujah if some of this competition actually works in favour of the consumer, because for a while there, with the decisions being made by the regulator, you'd wonder who was on whose side. But we were told, wait and see, and it'll all work well in the end. Now, the Irish Daily Star have a story about Gilligan's brother. The Irish Daily Mirror also have a crime story. And I suppose you could say it's a kind of a crime story on the Irish Sun, because it's about love, hate and zoo. The zoo in Dublin, the Zoological Gardens to you. And they're not going to be allowed to do love, hate there. By the way, just a word of warning. And be very careful about your language. And be very considered before you use the word disgusting. Because France's trade minister had to do a certain amount of apologising when she was caught on film saying that the food served at a state dinner for China's President Xi Jinping was disgusting. Apparently it was disgusting despite including foie gras and roasted poultry. But she said that the meal at the Prime Minister's office was way, way, way better. There was no comparison, because the one at the Elysee Palace was disgusting. There you go. Very careful of that word in future, folks. Now we are going to come to somebody else who I suppose will be eating and dining splendidly over the next some time. And I'm joined in studio by the British Ambassador to Ireland, Dominic Chilcott. Very welcome indeed. And I gather that you've been very much involved in organising the President's trip to England next week. First of all, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you. Secondly,
how do these things get organised? Just like to cut to the chase. Who says what and who decides what and who invites whom and who sets up venues and all that stuff?
Well, as you can imagine, Marion, this is not a straightforward process. It involves an awful lot of people. The two principal sides who have an extended conversation going on for weeks and months to nail down all the details are essentially the Office of the President at the Oris and the Royal Household and Buckingham Palace. And the two embassies, the Irish Embassy in London and the British Embassy in Dublin, we have our supporting roles in all of this. Now, because the visit is taking place in Britain, the Irish Embassy in London have a particularly important role to walk the course and to organise some of the events locally as well.
As presumably the British Embassy had to do here.
Yes, indeed. When the Queen came here 3 years ago, my predecessor, Julian King, and colleagues in the Embassy found that all the oxygen in the room, as it were, was taken up by preparing for the Queen's visit here for several months. So it is an enormous undertaking for everybody who's involved because these state visits are very substantial occasions, and in the case of President Higgins's visit, it's four very full days of
activities. They sure are very, very full. There's not a lot of time for drawing a breath. But I'm interested to know the process. Like, does the President say, "I would like," or does the Queen's household say, "We would suggest"?
Well, this is a very good point. It is a genuine sort of mutually arrived at position as a result of suggestions from both sides. Now, there are a certain number of things in an inward state visit to the United Kingdom which are usual for the state visit. So, for example, the white tie banquet hosted by the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh would be a familiar item, as would the event at the City of London where the Lord Mayor of the City of London hosts also similar hospitality. And then there are other things that other state visitors have done if they're particularly esteemed, like the address to a meeting of the joint Houses of Parliament and the laying of a wreath at the tomb of the unknown warrior in Westminster Abbey. So there's a certain formality with which we're used, and we would encourage, and we did encourage, and the President was very happy to do so, to do all the normal, what you might call the formal stuff. Then in addition, there's a further conversation between the Oris and the Palace about what other things it would be useful for or the President would like to do that draw attention to the nature of the connections between the two countries. And that is genuinely both sides suggesting things. And, you know, as a result of a process, it goes on
Coventry.
For weeks.
Coventry. Yeah. How did Coventry?
Well, I think Coventry came about partly because the President wanted to acknowledge that this is the year of the 450th anniversary of the birth of Shakespeare. And being a man who loves the theatre and loves the arts, he wanted to go to Stratford-upon-Avon, to the Royal Shakespeare Company. And then the thought was, if he's gone to Stratford and there's time for one more serial before he goes, where would it make sense to go? And the idea came from the Irish side, that they thought Coventry, with its cathedral, which is so resonant of peace and reconciliation, was a symbolic place to go to. And there's a very long-established Irish community in Coventry as well. So it actually makes very good sense if you're in Stratford to go to Coventry, where you can go to the cathedral and you can see the work that the cathedral does for peace and reconciliation, and then have a meeting with the Irish community from the East Midlands. And in a way, that's quite a good moment to finish the visit, because the President can reflect on the previous 4 days with the Irish community in Britain before he heads off.
Right. And when did those who run Coventry Cathedral get this happy news?
Well, they will have learned some weeks ago. So this is, you know, there are no last minute surprises usually for a state visit.
Right.
This is all planned well in advance.
I can well imagine. So who would have contacted them? I'm just interested in the nuts and bolts of how it's all done.
Well, it wasn't the British Embassy in Dublin, so I'm not entirely sure who made the first phone call to them. But it might well have been it's the Lord Chamberlain's office in the Royal Household, who are the people who are formally in charge from the UK end in putting together the programme. So it may have been them, or it may have been the Irish Embassy in London on behalf of the Oros, saying this isn't the somewhere we're thinking of.
Right. Mm. And is this universally greeted with delight or, dear Lord, why were we picked?
No, I think... I mean, it is a lot of work, you're right. It is a lot of work for everybody concerned, but it's also a very high honour.
Mm.
And I can't think of anywhere that that's approached, or anyone who's approached to be part of the state visit who isn't actually absolutely delighted. And, of course, everybody sees the importance of this visit and what it symbolises and what it can bring, and want to be, you know, they want to
be part
of that.
What does it symbolise?
Well, I think it builds on the Queen's visit here 3 years ago. So it consolidates that improvement in the relationship, and it drives forward with extra momentum, I think, to take it to the next level. And then it highlights a number of really really important themes. And this can be quite a long list, so you must interrupt me if I go on too long down this list. I mean, first of all, you know, the state visit is the highest form in protocol terms of diplomatic engagement that you can have one country with another. So it's the way the British establishment shows its respect for Ireland and the office of the President of Ireland in the most formal way that we can do that. So, and that is an important thing to do. I think, secondly, it shows and will draw attention to the sort of people-to-people and family links. Chris Patten was here yesterday, and he spoke at a dinner organised by PwC. And he began his talk, as so many British people do when they come to Ireland, by saying, of course, my grandparents came from here, or my, you know, I had an uncle who was from here or whatever.
Yeah.
And he said his grandparents came over from Ireland. They were school teachers in the north of England. His father, similarly. And when his father died early, his mother married again, and she married the local GP, who was an Irishman from Mayo. So that sort of intertwining of our peoples is felt very strongly in Great Britain.
Yeah, the funny thing about it is, well, it's certainly very valuable in terms of soccer from time to time, but there's an ambivalence here about that, because while it has been terrifically helpful for Irish people in bad times to have had Britain to go to look for work, there's an ambivalence on our part, because we feel that our emigration in another way is a failure.
Yeah. No, I understand that. And one's conscious, and has been conscious in the last couple of years, about the debate in Ireland about emigration and what it says about the success of the country's economy. But, you know, it is a historical fact that, you know, in the 1840s, for example, in the famine years, there was a huge emigration from the island of Ireland to the United Kingdom. And there are many people whose connections back to Ireland date from that period. And then in the 50s and the 60s, there was another very big wave of emigration from Ireland to the UK. As a result, actually, one of the aspects of that is that generation of migrants to the UK are now quite elderly. And one of the things the president will be doing is he's going to go to a university college hospital, and he wants to look at care for the elderly in that hospital and meet nurses from Ireland and doctors from Ireland who've worked in the National Health Service. So I think that's quite a good little cameo, in a way, of what this visit is about, because you can go to a hospital, you can draw attention to public service and the importance of public service and good health care, and the contribution made by people from Ireland or their descendants to that particular aspect of British life.
Yeah, the amount of Irish-born people living in Britain now is quite astonishing.
It is astonishing. We reckon there are about 500,000 living in GB who were born in Ireland. And we
half
think,
a million?
Half a million. And we think
that's
it's...
That's 25% of our... Isn't it?
Well, you're about 4.6 million people here, so it's a significant proportion.
Not 25%. Sorry about that.
But I mean, even I think more impressive than the 500,000 who were born in Ireland who live in GB are the numbers of people in GB who have or had an Irish grandparent, which I think means that if they wished to, they qualify for an Irish passport, and we reckon that's about 10% of our population. Which means that there are more people in GB who qualify for an Irish passport than there are residents here in the Republic. I think that just shows you how close we are not just we're not just countries that are neighbours. We are countries where there has been historically a great mixing of the peoples.
Yeah, but there sure has, and I presume that to go back to that ambivalence that everybody will be treading a kind of a careful line about that.
Well, I hope actually that people will be celebrating the fact that we have this very successful Irish community in Britain, and people of Irish descent. But I think what there is to celebrate is that maybe 20, 30 years ago, some of the Irish migrants that came over to Britain were not welcomed as perhaps they should have been. And certainly during the worst days of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, I think that many people in that community felt very inhibited and felt maybe there was certain hostility towards them.
Well, and then many people here would say, understandably, I mean, if people are going to go over and bomb you, you bear that in mind, I suppose, you know.
But I think the good thing about where we are now, following the peace process and this rapprochement in relations between Britain and Ireland, is that, we can all acknowledge what a great contribution that these waves of migration over the years have made to British life. Mm. And how many people in senior positions of British life have this family connection back to Ireland? Yeah. And it is quite remarkable how
in
many
industry as well. I was very interested to see that. Because if you take the first wave, well, in the 20th century, the first wave, generally speaking, uneducated, generally speaking, manual labourers, and women not educated either. But it's just very interesting to see how that has all evolved and changed in the city and in industry and all of those kinds of roles and posts.
Exactly. And of course, construction and the construction sector has always been an area with a lot of Irish strength in GB and some of our best known big construction companies like Lang O'Rourke and Jay Murphy and people. I mean, they have obvious Irish names.
Yeah.
But it's no longer confined to the construction sector by any means. Something like, I think the latest figure is over 50,000 directors of British companies are Irish people. And that is a number that far outweighs any comparable number of, as it were, foreign directors of British companies. Mm. So the profile of Irish people who go to Britain to work these days, quite often highly educated young professionals who are lured by the excitement of being in London or Manchester or wherever it is, and the opportunities that are available there.
Right. Let me talk a little bit about yourself before we talk any more about Britain and Ireland. And I thought it was interesting reading your own biog that it slightly shadows or matches or mirrors is the word I want. A previous ambassador who was also in here, as indeed was his wife at one stage for an interview, David Redaway. You were born in Hong Kong.
I was, yes.
He wasn't, but you know.
I don't know where David was born, but yes, we were born. I was born overseas. But what we have in common, of course, is that we both served in Turkey and we both served in Iran. Although I think David's, and then we both had difficulties with Iran.
Certainly,
David, having served in Iran, was then refused permission by the Iranians to go back later as ambassador to Iran. And in my case, I went out as ambassador to Iran and then got kicked out. So,
Describe to us how that happened.
Well, it was the result of a demonstration outside the embassy, which transformed into a mob attack over the embassy gates and walls against the embassy. And to cut a long story short, as it were, after several hours of barricading ourselves in, and then finding somewhere to hide when we had to leave the place that we'd barricaded ourselves into because they set fire to the building. Eventually, the mob was called off by the authorities after they let them have several hours of having their fun and games with us. Fortunately, we were all unscathed, and we went round to, and I'll always be grateful for this, we went round to the French ambassador's residence, which was nearby, and we gathered our colleagues who had simultaneously been attacked in the other compound that we had in Tehran, and all grouped ourselves together, and our government rightly took the decision while this was going on that, you know, this was not a basis on which we could keep diplomats and their families in Iran any longer, and they ordered us to be withdrawn.
This was due to the sanctions?
This was the proximate cause for the attack on us was the demonstration was on the anniversary of the assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist, which had nothing to do with the UK, but the UK in Iran, for complicated historical reasons, is often seen as the hidden hand that gets up to no good. And And anyway, the mob decided to take it out on us. But the more general background was one of a growing sense of confrontation at the time between the Iranian regime that seemed intent on processing uranium, probably, well, we could find no other explanation other than probably because it had a sort of secret nuclear weapons program, and the West's response to that, in which the UK was a leading player, which was to increase the economic sanctions against Iran in order to dissuade it from continuing with its nuclear program and threatening its region. Now, the good news is these days, under the different president, there's been a different approach, and there have been some positive moves in trying to reach an accommodation which deals with our worries about Iran's nuclear program and would provide a pathway for lifting the economic sanctions.
Excuse me, sorry, I have a frog in my throat. Excuse me, I'll take a drink here.
I do, yeah.
Well, after that, I presume coming to Ireland was rather quieter.
It could not be a greater contrast, Marion. I think I know this country is famous for the warmth of its welcome, and it may sound a little bit of a cliche to say that, but from the day my wife and I arrived here, we were very much struck by how warmly we were welcomed and how everybody went out of their way to be nice and hospitable. And, you know, that has continued for the 2 years that we've been here. And so if Iran was characterised by a sense of looming confrontation and disaster all the time, here the experience has been one of the warmest of possible welcomes and a strong sense of doing things together and cooperation to improve, you know, the lot of everybody in both countries.
Will you be travelling with the president?
I shall be, yes, yes. I won't actually be on the executive jet that flies from Ireland over on Monday, the 7th of April, but I will already be in the UK. But then from the moment the visit starts proper, I will be in the party that goes with the president to all the places that he goes to.
Do you enjoy all that pomp and ceremony bit?
I do, actually. I'm not sure whether it's a very noble or virtuous thing to have to admit to. But I do like it. I like the ceremony, and I'm sure I'm going to enjoy all the kind of dressing up for the various occasions. And there is something theatrical about it, which is appealing. And of course, because these are traditions that go back hundreds of years, they have an authenticity which gives them value as well. But also, they are a mark of respect and esteem that people go to so much trouble to do all this to honour a visitor. And that's an important part of what we do, and I'm looking forward to all of that, yes.
Caller says, wishing the President a good visit to Coventry. I was born in Coventry of Irish parents in 1951, now living in Portlaoise for 30 years. Another caller says, it's great to see Ireland and the UK having much closer relations, as we have more that unites us than divides us. And I suppose on that note, that's the whole purpose of the exercise.
Absolutely, and it's not just to highlight that, but it's to say we have all this that unites us. We should be making the most of that for our own mutual benefit, and we should be, you know, as two friendly countries living close to one another, we should be making the most of that geographical proximity and everything else that we have in common for the general good, and that's the aim.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much indeed for coming into us, and I hope it's a terrific success.
Thank you, Marion,
okay,
very much.
Okay, thank you very much indeed.